The other context around how, you know, what happened in 2012 is because I was sexually abused when I was a child as well. So there was some trauma that I was unknowingly holding on to that had to manifest somehow. Turns out for me, that was this manic episode on that motorway in Italy. That inner stress had to come out somehow.
My guest today is ultra runner and award-winning speaker, Dan Keeley. In today's conversation, Dan openly shares his story and how a psychotic episode in 2012 reshaped his life. 5 years after the episode and his bipolar diagnosis, Dan decided to raise awareness for mental health and embarked on a 1,250-mile run from Rome to London. This is an incredible story of recovery, resilience, vulnerability, and being honest. I hope you enjoy. So I want to delve in to start with. So who was Dan before becoming the mental health activist and this ultra adventurer?
Just somebody who's just always worn my heart on my sleeve. I've always been, you know, pretty sporty and creative and love being around people. And just growing up over the years, just, you know, it's always been an ebbing and flowing between sport and creativity one way or the other. Unfortunately, over the years, I've managed to fuse the two together in my professional life. But passionate about the big wide world, qualified as a skiing instructor back in the day, you know, degree in sports management was about the business side of sport and sports sponsorship and community building. Just one way or the other, always outdoors, an amazing family that grew up down in East Sussex, brilliant big brother and sister, 4 years older than me, they're both twins, just a great pool of mates, and count my lucky stars really. I've had a lovely warm upbringing down in the southeast, and as I say, one way or the other, so my career's ebbed and flowed between sport and creativity in one way. So that's sort of the life before this whole chapter sort of really kicked off from 2012 onwards, for sure.
So what started this chapter then?
Yeah, it was actually when all of that came together in bucket loads. So there was this vacancy with a snow sports charity out there, and at the time I didn't even know such a thing existed. And, you know, having just qualified as a skiing instructor, I just couldn't believe A, that this charity existed, and B, that they were looking for a community and partnerships manager. So I jumped at the opportunity, and in 2012, I just got obsessed about having the biggest impact possible on these young people that we were supporting at the charity. And I just negated everything else. I just stopped looking after myself. You know, I was just so tunnel visioned on trying to raise another £500 to get another underprivileged young person out to the Alps, or, you know, a new partnership that would pay for, you know, a whole series of programs in the UK at the indoor snow slope. So, you know, I was just really obsessed about social impact and stopped focusing on anything else, my health, my relationships, other passions in my life and my sleep. You know, I remember back in 2012, there was a period for April that year where I averaged 2.5 hours sleep a night for over a fortnight. And, you know, I'm sure some of your listeners would have seen Homelands with Carrie when she's in that kind of manic state where you just feel like you can keep going and going and going. And, you know, my partner Georgie would wake up in the morning and there'd be streams of paper all over the lounge with his creative ideas. And, you know, it's like my foot was stuck to the accelerator and I just couldn't slow myself down. And getting to the crux of it, I had a full-scale psychotic episode on holiday in Italy in 2012. So after 6 months of my foot, you know, being planted to the floor, this adrenaline, this dopamine, just going and going and going, it led to losing my sanity, standing in the middle of a motorway on holiday in Italy, genuinely believing I was the chosen one, the one that was put on the planet to ease all the world's suffering. And obviously, by definition, I'd lost my mind and ended up in psychiatric wards.
So what happened subsequently then because of that? Like, what was the treatment like? What was life like after that episode?
Yeah, it was definitely a very confusing 6 weeks when I was on the wards. That was, you know, between Italy and the UK. Apparently I flew first class back to the UK, but I was drugged up. I didn't know anything about it. But, you know, I was well looked after by, it was actually the Home Office that supported my family to get me back to the UK. And I was with Georgie at the time as well. I was very lucky, obviously, to have her by my side. A few weeks out in Italy in the units there, which I've got to say was, you know, amazing. The level of care that was provided to me on their National Health Service out there was was quite special. And then, unfortunately, you know, going into the Maudsley Hospital in South London, you know, it's supposed to be one of the leading psychiatric units in the UK, but, you know, it was a pretty dire, damp, cold, dark, scary 3 weeks, really, in the Maudsley Hospital. And then obviously got the diagnosis of bipolar disorder just before being discharged. And there was something quite empowering about getting the diagnosis, because at least we were working with something, even if that didn't turn out to be the right diagnosis, which it actually was. At least we had something that we could focus on and channel our energy into as a family to try and get me back to a positive place. But certainly, yeah, what goes up must come down. And, you know, if you're going to reach those peaks mentally, then you're going to come down with a bang. And, you know, the next 6 months were very dark, and got to the point, Tom, where, you know, I went to grab the car keys to take a drive and, you know, yeah, have a look at a particular spot to do something I probably would have very much regretted. But that same day, you know, the car keys were hidden, you know, testament to the protection that I had around me. And I was lucky that I was in such a critical place that I was fast tracked to have counselling. So right from the off, pretty much every day to begin with, I was having counselling with my lifesaver, Grace, at the time. And just, you know, just count my lucky stars ever since, because, you know, I probably wouldn't be speaking to you now if it wouldn't have been for, you know, my family, my friends, and just that support network around me. And, you know, shout out to Grace, who was just this incredible counsellor. He just got me right from the off.
How has that diagnosis then with bipolar changed your life?
Yeah, you know, you're never out of the woods. You know, you have to really manage it. And, you know, touch wood, I haven't had any significant episodes since 2012. There have been periods of hypomania, which is a close call, a near miss, if you like. We can get to that, because there's certain chapters where that pops up, you know, consequently over the years. But it's something you always have to manage, and you have to be really aware of. And it's almost as though, you know, I've got seven gears, and it's very easy for my foot to get stuck on the accelerator again. You know, if I'm not sleeping too well, if I'm not exercising, if I'm not eating, you know, eating actually slows me down, and, you know, just makes sure that my body's focusing on other things rather than just expending all this energy all the time. However, what I will say is that, you know, there is this fine line where if you can harness that creative energy that comes with the package, then you can, but it's good use. And, you know, it kind of feeds into your original question about, you know, what's led to this new chapter in my life going into the mental health world. It's because, you know, I do believe, and I think Winston Churchill said this, is that when suffering finds meaning, it can so often cease to be suffering. And I think Viktor Frankl obviously championed that message from his time during World War II. But when suffering finds meaning, you know, so often can cease to be suffering. So, you know, I did dig deep over the next 5 years, really, to try and unpack those experiences and really listen to my counsellors, really listen to my friends, my family, pay attention to what was going on inside. Ultimately, I had permission to put myself first throughout, you know, the next couple of years to get back to a healthy place mentally. But yeah, it definitely forces you to ask yourself the big questions in life and what really matters most. So often, of course, that's family and friends and your health. Yeah. You know, perhaps it was all meant to be. And, you know, I'm happy sharing, Tom, as well, you know, the other context around how, you know, what happened in 2012 is because I was sexually abused when I was a child as well. So there was some trauma that I was unknowingly holding on to that had to manifest somehow. Turns out for me, that was this manic episode on that motorway in Italy. That inner stress had to come out somehow. But, you know, 10 years on now from that motorway incident, and definitely learned a few lessons along the way.
You're a big advocate for talking. You know, I think especially male mental health, we don't talk enough. So when you were abused, did you tell anyone about it? Did you speak about it? Or is it something you kind of suppressed a little bit?
Yeah, I unknowingly suppressed it. It wasn't until I was 21 when I was at university playing tennis with my mate Aaron. I was exhausted. You know, it was almost like my body was depleting my energy to make reserves for what was about to come. And I was literally playing tennis with my friend at the age of 21. And in that moment, I had this light bulb that, oh my God, something happened to me as a kid. And I've just seen the whole movie in my head. Wow. in the flash of an eye, yeah. In the flash of a moment. And, you know, it's just incredible how the body remembers. And, you know, I'm no expert on trauma and any of this stuff. And I've still got a long way to go to figure all of that stuff out. But my body was holding on to that trauma. So, you know, I didn't know that I was until I was 21 years old. And then certainly I think that was the slow unraveling. So throughout my uni days, there were definitely moments where my mood was heightened, and then I'd just go into my cave for the better part of a month and just be completely exhausted. And it was almost, as I say, it was like sort of being a Formula One car. Sometimes my foot will be on the accelerator. I feel like I could hit every apex and just keep going for 200 miles an hour, weeks upon ends. And then I just want to disappear and just not see anybody. And, you know, certainly from, yeah, around 2006 onwards, I'd say, you know, the unraveling was there. And then obviously it led up to what happened in 2012. But yeah, for sure, you know, after that quite defining year in 2012, it was then that journey of recovery that followed. And as I say, you know, there were some big lessons that came out of that. And, you know, particularly obviously around giving yourself permission to put yourself first when you need to. And everybody was telling me, just take your time, be patient. You know, this is all about compassion and empathy and patience, and getting back to a positive place mentally. You know, we've got all the time in the world to be the people we want to be. But just like your podcast, you know, you're delivering so much value, and I was craving to get back out there to impact people. You know, it's always been close to my heart anyway, but I just had to be really patient and start to practice what I was preaching about looking after yourself, I guess.
That's so important. Like, if you don't take care of what's going on now, then the future doesn't really matter. Just a quick thank you to one of today's podcast sponsors, Unlimited Beer. Now, Unlimited Beer offer alcohol-free lagers and IPAs, and honestly, since trying them, I know I'm supposed to say this, but I genuinely mean it. They're incredible. I cannot taste the difference. If anything, I prefer the taste and flavor. So if you're looking to cut down on alcohol or even quit for dry January or quit permanently, I implore you to check Unlimited Beer out. They also do regular discounts too. You can find them at www.unltd.beer. I hope you enjoy. Tell me some of the biggest lessons that you had. You mentioned there that it was just about being still and not forcing the future. So what else did you learn from that experience that you've taken on now?
Yeah, for sure. Well, yeah, there's a few things actually. And, you know, it's kind of pinned to different moments during that recovery. So certainly, you know, the overriding thing, which is what I speak to most about these days, is, you know, the power of putting yourself first when you need to, for sure. And I think, you know, it's pretty self-explanatory, but actually it's not hard to do. You know, it's quite hard to do in the times that we're living in to give yourself permission to put yourself first. You know, there are so many distractions, there's so many demands on our time, energy, and our attention these days. It's so easy to lose, you know, what's really going on inside. And so the more that we can do that, the better. But certainly, you know, I think, you know, in 2013, the year after, you know, when I was starting to get back out there and, you know, go back into the workplace or just reconnect with friends and family who I hadn't seen in some time, you know, I remember seeing and being, you know, I was almost like being really open about my experiences and what happened in Italy. I was quite honest and just wore my heart on my sleeve and said, look, these were the series of events and this is what happened. But the three things that really started to manifest every time I spoke up about my experiences is that I felt much lighter every time I spoke up. Yeah. I built an even greater support network around me, people that just spot those warning signs again if things looked a bit shaky. But really the most incredible observation was the power of vulnerability. You know, and just by being open about my experiences, time and again, I had many more people reaching out to me to say, you know, can we just have a chat? You know, I've got this thing going on, or my family member's struggling, or I've got a friend that's dealing with this. Can we have a conversation? And I just started realizing that so often, just by being vulnerable ourselves, you just never know who else you'll provide that safe space for other people to speak up. And, you know, I think that was really that early seeds that led to us having this conversation now, because, you know, for me, it didn't feel like a courageous act. It was just something that inherently, you know, I guess with my background in sports, you know, I've always been quite comfortable speaking to audiences and communities and what have you. So when people asked me about what happened in 2012, I was just honest. You know, I was just honest. It didn't feel courageous. I was just being honest about what happened and telling the story, telling the timeline of events. But, you know, people seemingly found real comfort and value in that to think, gosh, yeah, actually it's, you know, a lot of this is resonating with me. I can feel that pain. And, you know, I do believe that all of us struggle with something, you know, at different times. It doesn't matter who we are. So yeah, that sort of vulnerability piece was key. And then the other thing actually that plays a huge part in my recovery was minimalism and simplicity. So certainly before 2012, I don't think I was that intentional. I don't think I was that proactive with managing myself. But certainly, you know, I was forced into this position where I couldn't make the simplest of choices. My mind was broken. I had to start again. And I had to just strip it all back and start again. And so, you know, I decluttered my physical space around me, my digital space, if you like, my commitments, my aspirations, and I just kind of kept it simple to focus on the things that really matter most. Yeah. And, you know, consequently discovered the lifestyle approach of minimalism and simplicity, really being intentional with our time, our energy, and our attention. And for me, you know, ever since then, I've just really tried to light up these five light bulbs as much as possible: my health, my relationships, my passions, my growth, and hopefully contributing to other people as well. And that sort of leads up to then what happened in 2017, which is where our conversation, yeah, got started when we first connected, which was, you know, how can I celebrate these five pillars of what I'm really focusing on now: my health, my relationships, passions, growth, hopefully contributing to other people. And, you know, I had to come up with a big project to kind of bookend and celebrate this journey of recovery. But yeah, it wasn't easy. It was a 5-year timeline, I guess, between 2012 and 2017. But yeah, here we are talking now.
I think that's amazing. I just kind of want to go back to what you were saying there. And it's a lot to do with the work that you do now in terms of you being so honest with your story. And by being so honest with your story, you then allow other people to be honest with theirs. And I think that's a really positive thing. You know, I've spoken on this podcast before about some of the things in my own life personally. And one of them was, you know, I had a period of like quite bad anxiety. And recently I had a friend reach out who's, you know, really, really struggling with it. You know, he phoned me during a panic attack one day and just wanted to know, I remember you talking about this, like, can we talk about it? And it's the friend I least expected to do it. And it's like, oh, right, okay. We ended up like meeting and having conversations. And, you know, he was open enough to just tell me everything and be emotional in front of me. And I thought, do you know what? Like, that's one of the biggest, the most positive things that I've experienced, that someone could feel so open and honest with me. And I like to think, because you share stuff and you're honest and you're open, then you allow other people. And that's one of the best things that I've ever done. So I completely resonate with your story on that, with allowing other people to contact you and talk to you, because they resonate with what you've been through.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And, you know, I try and remind people of this today. You know, we all know how hard it is to speak up when we're struggling. You know, I still struggle at times, even though, you know, I'm in this whole world. But you just captured something there, which I do remind people of a lot, is that, you know, if you flip it, so often you're giving the other person a gift of being able to provide the safe space for you. You know, and just like you proven there, that friend reached out to you and you're still reflecting on that moment with color in your eyes and a smile on your face, because he gave you a gift. He gave you the gift of providing the safe space for him to speak up. And no doubt, you know, he would do the same for you in the future if you reached out to him. And that's the beauty of all of this stuff. You know, it's not easy. You know, I'm not sitting here after 10 years of being part of these conversations to say that it's easy. Just if you're struggling, speak up. It's never as easy as that. But there is always a safe space to speak up. There is. It might be at your sports club. It might be with your barber. It might be with your barman. It might be with your friends and family. Who knows? You know, everybody's got to find their own way. But yeah, there's one bit of, you know, it's a really key thing that you picked up on, because so often we can give that safe space to other people and give them the gift of helping us. At the end of the year, when our head hits the pillow and we look back, and, you know, it's a real joy to just know that we provided that safe and supportive, stigma-free environment for, you know, our closest ones to speak openly with us.
Yeah, I just think it's one of the best things you can do. And coming from a teaching background, like, you know, like myself, it's, I believe if not just the you know, the students I teach, you know, my friends and my family, I believe the best thing I can ever do is, like you said, create that safe space. So if anyone ever has a problem, they can come to me. I don't want to have a friend or a student or a family member to ever bottle anything up. I'd rather them just come to me and talk about anything. And I think what you mentioned there about vulnerability, being open and being honest, that allows that. And I think that's the way to start breaking the stigma, I guess, around talking.
Yeah, of course. And, you know, it's happening. You know, you've got the Royal Family chipping in with the conversation, obviously the great work of Movember and Campaign Against Living Miserably and MenSheds and Mates in Mind. And, you know, there's just so many great, great things happening now. And, you know, times are changing. We've got a long way to go. But, you know, the stats unfortunately still speak for themselves. But, you know, we've all gone through, you know, such a defining chapter over the past few years as well, that, you know, these conversations have never been more important. That's why it was a hell yes to jump on today, Tom, because, you know, I know you'd get this. And that's what this is about. You know, this is a safe space, and, you know, it's the kind of vulnerability with boundaries piece. Yeah, we're framing these conversations in the service of others, hopefully. And that's what it's all about. You know, we don't have to, you know, go about our daily lives necessarily just speaking openly to anybody all the time. Yeah, that's not what it's about, but it's, you know, it's just making sure that these conversations happen. And that's where, you know, the future hopefully is going to look bright for future generations for sure.
Yeah, let's hope so. So where did the idea come from then? Rome to home, 1,250 miles. Where did that idea come from?
Yeah, exactly. Well, as an extension of this, right? So, you know, that, you know, it's this 5-year journey of recovery. You know, I'm practicing what I'm preaching. I'm now feeling much more stable, both mentally, physically. I'm trail running again. You know, I'm out there, I'm being asked to share my story even more. So I'm focusing on those five pillars I mentioned. And, you know, this idea of returning to where this all happened, Italy. But this time, instead of standing on the middle of a motorway, you know, to try and pick out a route where I could take on a project, in this case, an adventure challenge, a 65-day adventure challenge, and use it as a platform to empower other people to speak up. Yeah. That was why Rome's Home was born. And at the time, I was really focused on men's mental health in particular. And it's still, unfortunately, the case now, 5 years on, that, you know, 12 men a day won't be with us tomorrow in the UK alone. And that's just registered, you know, suicides as well. So there's still so much work to be done. And these were pretty much the same stats back in 2017. So, you know, it's just this compulsion to bookend this chapter, to celebrate this journey of recovery, almost to thank everybody that had been with me on that journey, but also to play my part and to empower others to speak up. So I thought, if I could create a platform where, you know, I'm practicing what I'm preaching, I'm being demonstrative in my journey of recovery, but hopefully through the means of helping others to speak openly and say, look, you know, this is what, you know, this project, this oil painting that I'm stepping into for 65 days, and that's just unfolding in front of me. This is a manifestation of finding that courage to speak up when I was at my lowest. Hopefully, you know, you'll find some value in this as well. But yeah, it all came to life more beautifully than I could have imagined. So, you know, I was looking ahead to 2016 and, you know, really sort of toying with this idea of creating this project. And I remember New Year's Eve being opposite the London Eye, actually watching the fireworks. And that's where the idea of Rome to Home came into my head. It was just one of those few moments in life where it almost felt like the adventure was completed the moment I thought about it. It was the same when I just about committed to being a skiing instructor. You know, there's these few moments in life where it's a hell yes, and it's a no-brainer, and it's almost like you can see all the dots that, you know, you've just got to join the dots in front of you, and it's all mapped out. So yeah, certainly not necessarily an easy project to put together. It took a year to plan it properly. You know, I've never done you know, a self-hosted, self-supported adventure of this type at all. I'd never really identified as a runner before, not really. You know, I've been pretty sporty in my background, but not really a runner. So the whole thing was fueled by this cause, this mission. Yeah, it was just beautiful. So I set off on the 25th of August, in the height of summer. It was pretty hot down in Rome, running into Tuscany. But yeah, I had to get to the Alps before it got too chilly. And then I had to get home pretty much by the winter season to do some other work. But yeah, it just worked. It worked. It was 65 days, as you say, 1,250 miles, averaging 20 miles a day. Just me and my backpack, sleeping under the stars sometimes. I can't really describe it any other way than an oil painting. I can still taste that dust down in Tuscany. And it was just so warm and full of generosity and colour, and just pretty magic. And obviously, when I got back to the UK, yeah, there's a lot of great energy when I got back to London.
Mate, that's fantastic. So I'm gonna ask you two questions now, like the best bit and the hardest bit. So we'll start with the best bit. What was the best bit about that experience for you?
It's quite hard to pin down one thing. You know, there are a few highlights, right? So going up and over the Alps was unbelievable. You know, it was 5 days, 2.5 days up, 2.5 days down. My uncle actually flew into Milan Airport. He's a pilot, and then he surprised me by meeting up me at the top with a couple of beers when I came over the crest. So to have a family member surprise me at the crest, at the, you know, literally the peak of the Alps, having run there from the Colosseum, really magic. I'm going to dance around, you know, different moments of the adventure, but obviously setting off from Rome, arriving there a couple of days beforehand, standing next to the Colosseum, a few warm-up laps the night before, and just seeing that golden sunrise on the morning where this whole thing was going to start. And I just remember these beaming golden streams of light coming through the arches of the Colosseum, and it just felt like, this is where I'm supposed to be, this is what I'm supposed to be doing. And I remember that feeling actually, running over to the Vatican that first couple of miles, and this feeling of lightness came over me. It was like the hard work had been done, I've done all my preparation, what will be now, let's just enjoy the journey and just put one foot in front of the other, practice what I preach, look after myself. And so that feeling of lightness that came over me during those first couple of hours was actually quite special. Yeah, obviously Tuscany was very, very cool. The generosity of the Italians, plenty of people refunding my Airbnb, or, you know, just taking me in to sleep, you know, under their lean-tos with their house or their back gardens, or just pitching a tent on the trails at nights. I remember one guy actually arrived in a beautiful village, must have been on, I don't know, day 20 of the adventure or something, this, you know, out in the back of Italy somewhere. And, you know, after a couple of nights of being a bit stinky, you know, I was prepared to spend whatever, 40 quid to stay in a nice hotel, which this guidebook told me there was. It wasn't there. It'd been taken down 6 months before. And so I ended up sleeping under the stars, and this farmer came down the track at like 3 a.m. with a shotgun in the back of his tractor. And he was like, wait here. And I thought he was angry, but it turns out he wasn't. He just didn't want me to go anywhere, because he came back with 60 euros. And told me, good luck, you know, I love what you're doing. I had a little crib sheet which just explains what I was up to on this adventure, and he actually paid me. So I had this incredibly memorable moment sleeping under the stars. I saved 50 euros, he gave me 60 to go on and, you know, have some hot food, and, you know, towards the continued success of this whole thing that was going on. So it's just a nice example of you know, that sort of generosity. Yeah. My sister crossing the channel to meet me at Dieppe to go back over to New Haven. That was pretty cool. And then there is one particular highlight which you couldn't have really written. And that was on, I think it was as I was approaching Paris. I just clocked over 1,000 miles on the adventure. And my brother was just finishing up with the Red Arrows. So he was part of the Red Arrows RF display team for quite a few years. And they just finished a tour in the Middle East. They were refueling in southern Italy. And I got a message from all the Red Arrows saying, you know, Red 2's little brother, congratulations, you've just clocked over 1,000 miles. You know, we'll see you back in the UK. Which is amazing. And then I suddenly thought, well, hold on, if they're refueling in southern Italy and they're flying back to the UK, they must be, you know, they can't be too far from the route that I'm running, which is almost a direct line back up to the channel anyway. Yeah. Turns out that was the case. So my brother managed to organise a freaking flyover from the Red Arrows on the same day that I clocked 1,000 miles, just southwest of Paris. So I had my 9 streams of white smoke above me at altitude, and you just couldn't have written it. And it was unbelievable. It was really, really special. And there's no way that could have been planned. No chance. It was just this positive energy that encompassed the whole thing.
Yeah.
And obviously the charity were amazing. Calm, Campaign Against Living Miserably. They were there at the end. And then, yeah, there's over 150 people waiting for me at the London Eye when I crossed the channel over the South Downs, up through Sussex and Kent and into South London. And then, you know, that final blast from Greenwich Park over to the London Eye with Freddie Mercury blasting in my ears the whole time. And yeah, it's just really special, you know, arriving 65 days later.
What was your why that whole time?
Yeah, it was definitely, you know, internally, it was that closure.
Yeah.
From that 5-year chapter, for sure. There's definitely this kind of, I guess, a celebration, and a big thank you to everybody who supported me over those 5 years. It was definitely closure of one chapter and the starting of another. But yeah, certainly, you know, there wasn't one day where I didn't wake up feeling really connected to thousands of people that are struggling out there. And, you know, I felt that this adventure was playing its part to serve them, both with the money we were raising for the charity to keep the helplines open. But certainly, yeah, I just kept thinking of those 12 men every single day that won't be with us tomorrow. And it brought me to tears on so many occasions. It really did. And, you know, I just felt really connected to that from start to finish.
What was some of the hardest challenges that you faced during that time?
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously, but yeah, physically at times it was pretty demanding. You know, I think on day 4, you know, you're asking a lot of your body. Suddenly it's almost in shock because you're asking your body to wake up every day and, you know, to carry out this mileage, especially with the backpack, which is, you know, between 13 to 15 kilograms, sometimes with the extra water down in Tuscany in particular. Yeah. So there was definitely, you know, the physical moments, but the actual hardest moment was on day 15, I think it was, where, you know, I wake up to 5 different messages from friends and family back home saying they're a bit worried about me. you know, I was going too fast, too soon. I was averaging 28 miles a day. You know, I was just well in front of where I needed to be. Clearly I wasn't sleeping as well as I should be. Okay. And, you know, these daily vlogs that I was putting out just seemed really fast paced. You have to forgive me today, by the way. Sophia kept me up last night. So, you know, I have had a strong coffee this morning, but, yeah, certainly I was just, I seemed a bit wired, and they knew me better than I knew myself at that moment. And I was definitely hypermanic. And I think I was right on the cusp of going into full scale mania and putting the whole adventure in jeopardy. And there is one of my sort of YouTube clips where, you know, it's the most raw, vulnerable bit of footage that you'll ever see.
Yeah.
Certainly of me, because, you know, these bags under my eyes, and you could just see I'm so drawn out. It's almost like I'm not there physically. And I was just in tears because they were right. And, you know, it took me a couple of hours to process that. I was almost quite angry. I was like, no, I'm fine. I can just keep going. I feel great. You know, I feel really strong. I don't need to sleep almost. But, you know, they were just reminding me. It's like, Dan, come on, you've come on a long way. You put your heart and soul into this. And so that it was the hardest 2 hours, because I had to drop the ego. I had to take off the armor. I had to accept what they were telling me, let the light in, if you like, and just accept it. And, you know, no Formula One driver wants to be told to slow down. And that's how it felt. I felt like people were putting the brakes on in front of me. And that was hard. That was really, really hard. So I had to just slow down. I had to take the extra meds to make sure that I slept more and ate more. Really fortunately, two of my best mates came out on that pretty much the exact same day.
Yeah.
So I was really well looked after. And that's what I mean, Tom. You know, I really felt protected in one way or the other. And, you know, call that energy what you like. But, you know, I felt very looked after. But it was a really hard moment. And yeah, just for different reasons, because, you know, in that state when people are telling you you're not okay, it just brought everything back from where I was 5 years prior. So yeah, really, really tough moment. But, you know, again, after 3 days and just doing the right things, slowing down, eating more, just getting some sleep, dropping the mileage, remembering what matters most. Yeah, fortunately it went on to be a beautiful, beautiful adventure from there on.
That's incredible. And you raised a lot of money for some really, really good causes. Yeah. But for you, what did life look like afterwards?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, it's just been, you know, the biggest danger, I think, when I arrived at the end was that this would be another finish line, if you like, because, you know, with Snowcamp back in, you know, 2012, when I got offered that job, I felt like I'd crossed this finish line. I felt like I'd suddenly arrived. I felt like this is it. And, yeah, and obviously we, you know, we now know what happened. And, you know, I certainly did not want the same thing to happen when I got to the London Eye. So, you know, for me, it was definitely being really mindful of that. So certainly when I was north of Paris, you know, when I was, it was those last few weeks of the adventure, I just really tuned into the fact that I had faith that this would be a closing of one chapter and the start of another, but just, you know, be kind to yourself with whatever comes next. You know, that commitment to the cause is still there, of course, with my work, with, you know, speaking with teams and audiences and communities to ignite these conversations where I possibly can. You know, that same connection to this mission is still very much there. But yeah, certainly for the past 5 years, yeah, we've grown a family and just been enjoying the trails and the single stage ultra races. And yeah, just I guess still, yeah, pumping out my message where I possibly can, and, you know, planning some other ventures behind the scenes as well.
Did you find that when you finish, you hit a bit of a low? Because I read recently about, and I heard on another podcast about gold medal depression. I spoke to, actually, I was lucky enough to speak to a gold medal Olympian on here about a year or two ago. Cool. So she had a really unique story where she could hardly train before the Olympics, and she did a lot of visualization and things like that. And she was so focused on winning that gold medal. And then I asked her, so how did you feel when you achieved that? You know, because a lot of people want that feeling of self-actualization and they've reached their purpose and they've got fulfillment. And she said, I didn't really feel anything. What I did feel was that I inspired people, you know, her daughter, I inspired her. That was the reason I did it. But I felt low after, because I thought everything I ever wanted, it wasn't there. And I think, but I don't think you're going to say that, because everything that you've said so far has always been about the journey, not the destination.
Yeah, I love the way you've framed that. I think there was a little bit of craving another big run, and, you know, that's definitely still where I'm at today. And I've, you know, I've got some plans underway, but Yeah, there was, it was just so beautiful. I was very lucky to have those 65 days when I was out there, and there was a real purity that came with that experience. And I know not everybody is lucky enough to be in a position to do that. So there was that element of, craving what I experienced for sure. But, I listened to something recently with Malcolm Gladwell. I love his work, with his books and his podcast and everything he does. And he always talks about having five domains in your life, your passions, your friends, your family, whatever that is, your different passion projects in different domains as well. So he's got like his running, his writing, his family, his friends. And, he always likes to kind of make sure that he's part of five things. So as if one drops, then he's finding, self-identity and meaning and purpose and connection to society, community through these other domains. And I think, I learned a lot myself, I guess, with that, because Rome time was one thing, the running side of things was one thing, but the mental health side of things was another. Mm. Plus the fact that we always knew we wanted to start a family, since we have done over the past 5 years, and it's magic now. We've got two kids, and Max and Sophia are little adventurers in their own right, for sure. I did apply myself to other domains beyond just running, and I didn't rely on that too much. And I think that was the lessons from 2012 again, because it was all about the charity at the time. It was all about impacting those young people, and I put every egg into that basket, and it didn't end well, and then on that motorway, that was a singular message. I was trying to force the world to try and do something it didn't want to do, and I was just so focused on that impact, and it didn't end well. And so I knew certainly, north of Paris again, looking ahead to the end of this adventure, that whatever this next chapter brings, just don't attach too much of your self-worth to Rome to home. There's far more important things out there: your family, your friends, your loved ones, your other passions, the other impacts that you want to have out there, other future adventures. I was just quite kind to myself, I guess, after Rome time finished. But yeah, I can't sit here and say that I certainly didn't crave more adventures to come.
Of course. No, we all do. And it's a funny thing, isn't it? It's something we're not daunted by, but something we have a little bit of fear over. We know it's going to be a real huge undertaking and task, but we feel really excited by it. Then suddenly we do it, something we were almost fearful of and something we're excited about, and it's done. And then suddenly get that itch again to do it again. It's amazing how we just always want to lean into that discomfort now and again. But sometimes we're scared of the unknown. It's a fascinating topic.
And same with you, Tom, right? Like, your Instagram, by example, you're just here, there and everywhere on any given mountain that you can find across the UK. But, we could talk about this stuff in bucket loads, right?
Yeah, I love it. I'm one of those people, I don't want to waste time. I understand it's important to, slow it down sometimes. And obviously we need that now and again. But then I love utilizing stuff, and I like pushing myself, to the point where, Not that I'm going to like hurt myself or anything like that, but I just like exploring. I like finding out what I can do. I've got that interest. I guess that's why I started this podcast, because I'm fascinated by what makes people tick and what people do, and, incorporate that into my own life, really.
Yeah. No, you can see it. You can hear it in your voice. I'm lucky enough to see you now, and it's just in bucket loads. And I think, you've become really intentional with, what you want to pursue. And another thing where, I talk about around this whole thing is starting at the end and, sitting down with your 100-year-old self and having a conversation with them, celebrating the life that they've led, about the values that they stay true to and the impact that they've had, or the adventures that they've pursued, or the aspirations, or the family they've surrounded themselves by, and, celebrate your future self, write that chapter, look down the line, because it also takes the pressure off where you are now. It reminds you that you've got a lot of time ahead of you, to be the people that we want to be. And, some people's best days are in their 50s and 60s and 70s. We all have these highlight moments in our lives at different points, but it's a really healthy exercise every now and then just to remind ourselves that there's a big wide world out there, and there is plenty of time to pursue the things we want to. So just keep being kind to yourself and keep being intentional with what you want to pursue. And you've certainly done that with the podcast. And again, going back to those sort of five values, just flipping it onto yourself, Tom, you're in service of other people with this. You're always sharing your story with that bit of vulnerability. You are passionate about this. You grow every time you do one of these conversations. I can see that it's healthy for you because it's a passion project, so all of these things with that intentionality just really feeds into why I just love these conversations. And, when these conversations can happen, with these, really cool adventure challenges or physical challenges in the big wide world out on the trails or the ski slopes or wherever that may be, then it just adds a whole another dimension to the joy that can come from these pretty unique experiences.
It certainly does. And I think by being yourself and being intentional with what you do, you then allow other people to do it. You know, it's like, oh, he's doing that. He's not doing the same as what everyone else is doing. Maybe I can do that as well. And I just think if you're yourself, then that's all you can do. And this podcast is, like you said, it's a passion project. It's not money. It's nothing. It's because I enjoy it. And the messages that I get from people that it could add value to someone's life, that's what it's about. And having amazing conversations with people like yourself who have done these amazing things. And yeah, that's what it's really about for me. But I really like what you said there about looking at yourself in maybe 100 years time or whatever. You're 100 years old and you reflect back on your life and you think, did I actually live a life that I wanted, or did I do it for other people? And often people are in a position where they're forced not to be themselves at the moment. And they're really like, they could be unkind to themselves internally. And they've got this self-dialogue that they're not where they want to be in life. And it could be, I don't know, imposter syndrome. It could be their circumstances aren't allowing it yet. So maybe they'll give up. So for people who are listening now and aren't perhaps in the position they want to be in, and they've got this goal in mind. It doesn't have to be a fitness goal. It could be start the gym. It could be start their own business. It could be start a YouTube channel. It could be anything. What would your advice be to them to not let fear dictate their current circumstance?
Yes, you know, it's not always easy, right? You know, that's the first thing to say. It's really not. And, you know, I get that. And, you know, there's probably been a bit of procrastination on my part with other adventures because, you know, I've been focused elsewhere. But, you know, it's not always, you know, we need to be in a state of creativity you know, it takes a bit of courage to commit to those things. But, you know, certainly a bit of self-accountability can never be a bad thing. And it's the same with, you know, just even just down to the level of trail running for me. You know, if I don't have a trail run or an ultra run in the diary, it's quite easy to let myself slip. You know, I'm pretty self-driven, but you know, unless I've got a race that I know I'm accountable to myself to go and pursue, then you know, I'm not quite going to get there. But yeah, I think there's two things to say to that. One is pretty much linked to what we were just saying. It's around that self-authoring. So, you know, having that conversation with your future self, and, you know, even though, yes, we've got plenty of time ahead of us, you know, we're never going to be as young as we are now with as much energy as we are now to pursue those things. And you know, just asking yourself, what is the best that could happen? You know, it's so easy to think, what's the worst that could happen?
Yeah.
But also, you know, do you ask yourself, what is the best that could happen as well? You know, what if everything happens in the most beautiful way you hope it can with that new business or your fitness regime or that challenge you want to take on? And I think Mel Robbins talks about the 5-second rule as well. You know, we need to build that daily courage to pursue those things which our hearts are telling us. And so when we do have a compulsion to pick up the phone or send that email or talk to that person about that adventure, you know, just before we jumped on, I talked about Jamie Ramsey. I reached out to him ahead of Rome to Home to think, this is my plan, what do you think? And he was just somebody that's been there and done it. I had that compulsion to do it. I didn't overthink it. You know, I think, you know, I read somewhere recently that the head is somewhere where your soul goes to hide from the heart. So your head is somewhere that your soul goes to hide from the heart. And it really resonated with me because I think when we can shut out the noise and really listen to what's going on with our internal sat navs, our hearts, and to really pay attention to that, it's a really powerful thing. And so links with what Mel Robbins talks about with that daily you know, that daily courage to have that conversation, to send that text, to talk about that business, to whatever, speak to HMRC about what it takes to set up your accounts or whatever. You know, it's about action and it's about momentum. And, you know, so often it's a flywheel. And I think if you can nurture these habits of courage, I think most people will surprise themselves.
Yeah.
I really do. And obviously, yeah, the whole self-authoring, playing the long game, I think is always a good thing because, you know, if we don't recognize that there's always another chapter that we can start and there's always lessons to be learned from the past, then, you know, it can be pretty scary when you just think we're just going day by day by day. Another week's gone past, another year's gone past, and I didn't start that thing that I've been talking about for a few years now. You know, it can be quite a scary thing. So yeah, I hope there's a little bit of value in there.
Yeah. Rather have the fear of discipline than the fear of regret, I guess.
Nice. Yeah.
You know, that's what I always think. I would much rather have that fear of discipline and think, God, there's a lot of work. But when you, like you said, when you look down the tunnel vision and you see what you want your life to look like or what you want this project to look like, it's so worth it than never trying. You know, I've always been brought up with that attitude. If something excites me and if it's productive and it's positive, just give it a go. Like, worst that can happen is it doesn't go anywhere, but at least you tried. And I've always believed that in everything that I do. It's like, yeah, I fancy giving that a go. And if it doesn't get anywhere, then it doesn't matter really. You know, it's about building that confidence up, those micro steps of the Mel Robbins rule, the 5 seconds, building that confidence up. And then suddenly a few months down the line or a year down the line, you're doing these things that the old you would never have done.
Yeah, no, 100%. And, you know, I think Tim Ferriss always says that beautiful line, like, what would this look like if it were easy? You know, what would this look like if it were easy? You know, if you're starting that new business, what would this look like if it were easy?
Yeah.
If you're thinking about that adventure challenge, what would this look like if it were easy? Yeah. And there's something really beautiful about that, because, you know, it just clears away a lot of the fluff. And certainly with Rent to Home, you know, I guess I did ask myself that question, but not so succinctly. But, you know, it wasn't about being an influencer. It wasn't about social media followers. It wasn't about, you know, it wasn't about much else other than putting one foot in front of the other, celebrating the journey and raising money for Calm and, you know, hopefully helping a few other people to speak up. And if it's done that, then I've done my job. You know, it wasn't much beyond that. But, you know, whatever that passion project is or that new chapter in your life that you're looking to pursue, that new relationship maybe, what would it look like if it were easy? I think it's quite an enlightening question to ask yourself, whatever that next project is for you.
I wanted to ask you some pretty quick fire questions, so it can be done in a few sentences. So first one is, what's the best advice you've ever received?
I've got it up on my wall, and it's stuck with me for the past 10 years now. And it's just simply this: when writing the story of your life, don't let anybody else hold the pen.
I love that. What's the worst advice you've ever received?
You know, I think, I get the sentiment that people were telling me. It was actually before Rome to Home. There was a bit of concern about going out there. You know, I still, you know, not 100% stable in my mind. And, you know, I had to do a lot of work with the medication to get that right. And, you know, people were just worried about me. And the way that was communicated was, you know, safety first and play it safe. And perhaps you shouldn't do this adventure. And perhaps it's not sensible. But, you know, they were missing the point. They saw that it was a compulsion. I had to do it. It was cathartic. It was a healthy thing. So yeah, it's not succinctly put, but, you know, just always playing it safe is, you know, where's the passion in that? Sometimes you have to stick your neck out a bit. And I think we only learn to fly when we jump off sometimes. And I don't know. I'm a heart on my sleeve kind of person, so that's not going to resonate with everybody. But yeah, playing it too safe all the time, doesn't set my soul on fire for sure.
No, I agree. You've got to have some risk in there.
You've got to have a bit of risk. Yeah,
of course, that's
where the fun lies for sure.
Exactly. So I actually thought of this question the other day. I was reading a book and this question came up. So, and I wanted to ask you this question because of the work that you've done for mental health and the challenges that you've done. What's one thing you'd change about the world if you could?
Yeah, I think if you'd have asked me this question a few years ago, it probably would have been quite different. But I think certainly having been on this journey, I guess, for over 10 years now and just being part of these conversations, I think we need way more compassion around the world right now.
Agreed.
And that's both for ourselves and each other. It's ridiculous out there at the moment.
Yeah.
It really is. And I think so many people are feeling it. And, you know, a lot of people's heads are down and, you know, the whole social media culture, we're just nitpicking at each other and the kind of polarity with, you know, unless you throw in a strong opinion, then, you know, you're not going to get the retweets and the hearts. And, you know, where's the middle ground in that? Where's the human dialogue in the middle, you know, trying to have the empathy and compassion for each other? You know, I think compassion, we just need it in bucket loads right now. And, you know, on the flip side, I think, you know, we've still got a long way to go to eradicate the stigma and the shame connected with mental health, you know, and that's always an interesting conversation. And we could be here for weeks talking about that because, you know, in certain settings, I completely get how scary it is to speak up, whether you're in the armed forces or whether you're whatever in the construction industry. There's huge issues because, you know, there aren't many safe spaces for men to speak openly out of fear of stigma and shame. And there's so many different examples. I've just picked out a couple there, but, you know, a world where there's far less shame and stigma attached to the mental health conversation when we're struggling would be a far more beautiful world. And, you know, I guess, you know, it still fuels me today that I just really wish that every single one of us has three things: the courage, the support, and the safe space to speak up. I guess if it came down to one thing that I wish everybody had around the world, it would be, those three things, I guess. But, you know, the courage to speak up when we're struggling, the support to speak up, you know, and that's obviously linked to the shame and stigma piece. And then, you know, the safe space to do it. And, you know, those safe spaces are out there. And the support is out there actually, but you know, it's not always easy to speak up when we're struggling. So yeah, between having far more compassion and far less stigma around, and you know, hopefully everybody in the world having those three things, that's certainly the world that I'd like to see. And you know, I like to think I'm playing my part in a small way to try and create for my son Max, my daughter Sophia, and future generations. But you know, it's happening. I do believe that great things are happening to them, and got high hopes for better days to come for sure.
Absolutely. And you're doing those things. Last question. What's next? Do you have anything planned?
We've got a first ski trip with the little ones. I'm looking forward to that, because you know, just getting Max in particular out to the mountains, he's 3.5 now, and you know, just for him to experience that and to open his eyes to the big wide world is going to be really special. But yeah, I would be lying again if I wasn't sitting here with two projects in mind. One of which is nowhere near coming to fruition. It's fine. It's quite a bigger project for way down the line, probably. But really happy to say that, you know, I'm thinking about going back again. I'm thinking about home to Rome, but in half the time, with a slightly different social message attached. Yeah. I've got to find the right window of opportunity to do it. But certainly the wheels are in motion. And as I say, I've always been hot on my sleeve and quite happy to put that one out there, that, you know, that is certainly... it's moved beyond just thinking about it to when could we do this, and if we can do it, who do I need to speak to? So yeah, I'll keep you posted, but home to Rome may well be on the cards.
Amazing. Dan, thank you for your time today and being so honest and open. It's been one of my favorite conversations that I've had on here. So no, thank you.
Awesome. Yeah. Cheers, Tom. Just keep it up with the podcast. These conversations really matter.
Okay, just before we finish the podcast today, I want to mention and thank this week's podcast sponsor. NatureCan is a carbon neutral, vegan friendly CBD and wellness brand founded by the ex-CEO of MyProtein, Andy Duckworth. NatureCan's mission is to help millions of people discover products that help them lead healthier and happier lives. From my own experience of trying the products, I found that the tinctures have massively supported my sleep and that overall feeling of calm. If it's your thing, go and check them out. Their website is uk.naturecan.com and use Tom15 for a discount.